for Bad Billy. Their son, Albert, was being born in one bed, even as poor Ronald was dying in another down the hall. "Are you paying close attention, sweetling?"
"Yes, there was John and Alice and Ronald, but Ronald died."
"Good. Now, John Aaron married thrice, but his first two wives gave him no children, so for long years his nephew, Albert, was his heir. Meantime, Ellis was ploughing Alice quite dutifully, and she was whelping once a year. She gave him 9 children, 8 girls and 1 precious little boy, another Jasper, after which she died, exhausted. Boy Jasper, inconsiderate of the heroic efforts that had gone into begetting him, got himself kicked in the head by a horse when he was 3 years old. A pox took 2 of his sisters soon after, leaving 6. The eldest married Sir Dennis Aaron, a distant cousin to the Lords of the Airy. There are several branches of House Aaron scattered across the vale, all as proud as they are penurious, save for the Gultan Aarons, who had the rare good sense to marry merchants. They're rich, but less than couth, so no one talks about them. Sir Dennis hailed from one of the poor, proud branches, but he was a renowned jouster, handsome and gallant and brimming with courtesy, and he had that magic Aaron name, which made him ideal for the eldest Wainwood girl. Their children would be Aarons, and the next heirs to the Vale should any ill befall Albert. Well, as it happened, Mad King Aerys befell Albert. You know that story?
She did. The Mad King murdered him.
He did indeed, and soon after, Sir Dennis left his pregnant Wainwood wife to ride to war. He died during the Battle of the Bells of an excess of gallantry and an axe. When they told his lady of his death, she perished of grief, and her newborn son soon followed. No matter, John Aaron had gotten himself a young wife during the war, one he had reason to believe fertile. He was very hopeful, I'm sure. But you and I know that all he ever got from Lysa was stillbirths, miscarriages, and poor sweet Robin. Which brings us back to the 5 remaining daughters of Ellis and Alice. The eldest had been left terribly scarred by the same pox that killed her sisters, so she became a scepter. Another was seduced by a sellsword. Sir Ellis cast her out, and she joined the Silent Sisters after her bastard died in infancy. The third wed the Lord of the Paps, but proved barren. The fourth was on her way to the Riverlands to marry some bracken, when Burn Man carried her off. That left the youngest, who wed a landed knight sworn to the Wainwoods, gave him a son that she named Harold, and perished. He turned her hand over and lightly kissed her wrist. "So, tell me, sweetling, why is Harry the heir?"
Her eyes widened. "He is not Lady Wainwood's heir, he's Robert's heir. If Robert were to die..."
Peter arched an eyebrow. "When Robert dies... Our poor brave sweet Robin is such a sickly boy, it's only a matter of time. When Robert dies, Harry the heir becomes Lord Harold, Defender of the Vale, and Lord of the Airy. John Aaron's bannermen will never love me, nor our silly, shaking Robert, but they will love the young falcon. And when they come together for his wedding, and you come out with your long auburn hair, clad in a maiden's cloak of white and grey, with a dire-wolf emblazoned on the back, why, every knight in the Vale will pledge his sword to win you back your birthright. So those are your gifts for me, my sweet Sansa. Harry the Airy and Winterfell. That's worth another kiss now, don't you think?"
Brain.
"This is an evil dream," she thought.
But if she were dreaming, why did it hurt so much? The rain had stopped falling, but all the world was wet. Her cloak felt as heavy as her mail. The ropes that bound her wrists were soaked through, But that only made them tighter. No matter how Brian turned her hands, she could not slip free. She did not understand who had bound her or why. She tried to ask the shadows, but they did not answer. Perhaps they did not hear her. Perhaps they were not real. Under her layers of wet wool and rusting mail, her skin was flushed and feverish. She wondered whether all of this was just a fever dream. She had a horse beneath her, though she could not remember mounting. She lay face down across its hindquarters like a sack of oats. Her wrists and ankles had been lashed together. The air was damp, the ground cloaked in mist. Her head pounded with every step. She could hear voices, but all she could see was the earth beneath the horse's hooves. There were things broken inside of her. Her face felt swollen. Her cheek was sticky with blood, and every jounce and bounce sent a stab of agony through her arm. She could hear Podrick calling her, as if from far away.
"Sir," he kept saying, "sir, my lady, sir, my lady."
His voice was faint and hard to hear. Finally, there was only silence. She dreamt she was at Harrenhal, down in the bear pit once again. This time it was Biter facing her, huge and bald and maggot-white, with weeping sores upon his cheeks. Naked he came, fondling his member, gnashing his file teeth together. Brian fled from him.
"My sword!" she called. "Oathkeeper, please!"
The watchers did not answer. Renly was there, with Nimble Dick, and Caitlin Stark, Shagwell, Pig, and Timian had come. And the corpses from the trees with their sunken cheeks, swollen tongues, and empty eye sockets. Brian wailed in horror at the sight of them, and Biter grabbed her arm and yanked her close and tore a chunk from her face.
"Jamie!"
she heard herself scream.
"Jamie!"
Even in the depths of dream, the pain was there. Her face throbbed, her shoulder bled, breathing hurt. The pain crackled up her arm like lightning. She cried out for a maester.
"We have no maester," said a girl's voice. "Only me. I'm looking for a girl," Brian remembered. "A high-born maid of 3 and 10 with blue eyes and auburn hair." "My lady," she said. "Lady Sansa."
A man laughed.
"She thinks you're Sansa Stark. She can't go much further. She'll die." "One less lion. I won't weep."
Brian heard the sound of someone praying. She thought of Septon Meribald, but all the words were wrong.
"The night is dark and full of terrors, and so are dreams."
They were riding through a gloomy world, a dank, dark, silent place where the pines pressed close. The ground was soft beneath her horse's hooves, and the tracks she left behind filled up with blood. Beside her rode Lord Renly, Dick Crabb, and Varga Holt. Blood ran from Renly's throat. The goat's torn ear oozed pus.
"Where are we going?" Brian asked. "Where are you taking me?"
None of them would answer.
How can they answer? All of them are dead.
Did that mean that she was dead as well? Lord Renly was ahead of her, her sweet, smiling king. He was leading her horse through the trees. Brian called out to tell him how much she loved him. But when he turned to scowl at her, she saw he was not Renly after all. Renly never scowled.
"He always had a smile for me," she thought.
Except...
"Cold,"
her king said, puzzled, and a shadow moved without a man to cast it. And her sweet lord's blood came washing through the green steel of his gorget to drench her hands. He had been a warm man, but his blood was cold as ice.
"This is not real," she told herself. "This is another bad dream, and soon I'll wake."
Her mount came to a sudden halt. Rough hands seized hold of her. She saw shafts of red afternoon light slanting through the branches of a chestnut tree. A horse rooted amongst the dead leaves after chestnuts, and men moved nearby, talking in quiet voices. 10, 12, maybe more. Brain did not recognize her faces. She was stretched out on the ground, her back against a tree trunk.
"Drink this, milady," said the girl's voice.
She lifted a cup to Brain's lips. The taste was strong and sour. Brain spat it out.
"Water," she gasped. "Please, water."
"Water won't help the pain. This will, a little."
The girl put the cup to Brian's lips again. It even hurt to drink. Wine ran down her chin and dribbled on her chest. When the cup was empty, the girl filled it from her skin. Brian sucked it down until she sputtered,
"No more! More! You have a broken arm, and some of your ribs is cracked. 2, maybe 3.
"Bite her,"
Brian said, remembering the weight of him, the way his knee had slammed into her chest.
"Aye, a real monster, that one."
It all came back to her. Lightning above and mud below, the rain pinging softly against the dark still of the hound's helm. The terrible strength in Biter's hands. Suddenly she could not stand being bound. She tried to wrench free of her ropes, but all that did was chafe her worse. Her wrists were tied too tightly. There was dried blood on the hemp.
"Is he dead?"
she trembled.
"Bite her. Is he dead?"
She remembered his teeth tearing into the flesh of her face. The thought that he might still be out there somewhere, breathing, made Brian want to scream.
"He's dead. Gentry shoved a spear point through the back of his neck. Drink, milady, or I'll pour it down your throat."
She drank.
"I'm looking for a girl,"
she whispered between swallows. She almost said, "My sister."
"A highborn maid of 3 and 10, she has blue eyes and auburn hair."
"I'm not her."
No, Brian could see that. The girl was thin to the point of looking starved. She wore her brown hair in a braid, and her eyes were older than her years.
"Brown hair, brown eyes, plain. Willow, 6 years older. You're the sister, the innkeep."
"I might be," the girl squinted. "What if I am?"
"Do you have a name?"
Brian asked. Her stomach gurgled. She was afraid that she might retch.
"Edel. Same as Willow. Jane Edel." "Jane. Untie my hands. Please have pity. The ropes are chafing my wrists. I'm bleeding."
"It's not allowed. You ought to stay bound till—"
"Till you stand before milady."
Renly stood behind the girl, pushing his black hair out of his eyes.
"Not Renly. Gendry."
"Milady means for you to answer for your crimes."
"Milady?"
The wine was making her head spin. It was hard to think.
"Stoneheart, is that who you mean?"
Lord Randall had spoken of her back at Maidenpool.
"Lady Stoneheart."
"Some call her that. Some call her other things. The Silent Sister, Mother Merciless, the Hangwoman."
"The Hangwoman?"
When Brian closed her eyes, she saw the corpses swaying underneath the bare brown limbs, their faces black and swollen. Suddenly she was desperately afraid.
"Podrick, my squire, where is Podrick and the others? Sir Hyle, Septon Merribald, Dog, what did you do with Dog?"
Gendry and the girl exchanged a look. Brian fought to rise and managed to get one knee under her before the world began to spin.
"It was you killed a dog, milady,"
she heard Gentry say, just before the darkness swallowed her again. Then she was back at the Whispers, standing amongst the ruins and facing Clarence Crabbe. He was huge and fierce, mounted on an oryx shaggier than he was. The beast pawed the ground in fury, tearing deep furrows in the earth. Crabbe's teeth had been filed into points. When Brian went to draw her sword, she found her scabbard empty.
"No!"
she cried as Sir Clarence charged. It wasn't fair. She could not fight without her magic sword. Sir Jamie had given it to her. The thought of failing him, as she had failed Lord Renly, made her want to weep.
"My sword, please! I have to find my sword!"
"The wench wants her sword back," a voice declared. "And I want Cersei Lannister to suck my cock. So what?"
"Jamie called it Oathkeeper, please."
But the voices did not listen, and Clarence Crabbe thundered down on her and swept off her head. Brian spiraled down into a deeper darkness. She dreamed that she was lying in a boat, her head pillowed on someone's lap. There were shadows all around them, hooded men in mail and leather, paddling them across a foggy river with muffled oars. She was drenched in sweat, burning, yet somehow shivering too. The fog was full of faces.
"Beauty,"
whispered the willows on the bank. But the reed said,
"Freak, freak."
Brain shuddered.
"Stop," she said. "Someone make them stop."
The next time she woke, Jane was holding a cup of hot soup to her lips.
"Onion broth,"
Brain thought. She drank as much of it as she could until a bit of carrot caught in her throat and made her choke. Coughing was agony.
"Easy,"
the girl said.
"Gendry,"
she wheezed.
"I have to talk with Gendry."
"He turned back at the river, m'lady. He's gone back to his forge, to Willow, and the little ones, to keep them safe."
"No one can keep them safe."
She began to cough again.
"Ah, let her choke. Save us a rope."
One of the shadow men shoved the girl aside. He was clad in rusted rings and a studded belt. At his hip hung longsword and dirk. A yellow greatcloak was plastered to his shoulders, sodden and filthy. From his shoulders rose a steel dog's head, its teeth bared in a snarl.
"No,"
Brian moaned.
"No, you're dead. I killed you."
The hound laughed.
"You got that backwards. It'll be me killing you. I'd do it now, but my lady wants to see you hanged."
"Hanged?" The word sent a jolt of fear through her. She looked at the girl, Jane.
"She is too young to be so hard. Bread and salt,"
Brian gasped.
"The inn, Septon Merrybowl, fed the children. We broke bread with your sister."
"Guessed right don't mean as much as it used to," said the girl. "Not since m'lady come back from the wedding. Some of them, swinging down by the river, figured they were guests too."
"We figured different,"
said the hound.
"They wanted beds. We gave them trees."
"We got more trees, though,"
put in another shadow, one-eyed beneath a rusty pot-helm.
"We always got more trees."
When it was time to mount again, they yanked a leather hood down over her face. There were no eye-holes. The leather muffled the sounds around her. The taste of onions lingered on her tongue, sharp as the knowledge of her failure.
"They mean to hang me."
She thought of Jamie, of Sansa, of her father back on Tarth, and was glad for the hood. It helped hide the tears welling in her eyes. From time to time she heard the outlaws talking, but she could not make out their words. After a while, she gave herself up to weariness and the slow, steady motion of her horse. This time she dreamed that she was home again, at evenfall. Through the tall, arched windows of her Lord Father's hall, she could see the sun just going down.
"I was safe here. I was safe."
She was dressed in silk brocade, a quartered gown of blue and red, decorated with golden suns and silver crescent moons. On another girl it might have been a pretty gown, but not on her. She was 12, ungainly, and uncomfortable, waiting to meet the young knight her father had arranged for her to marry, a boy 6 years her senior, sure to be a famous champion one day. She dreaded his arrival. Her bosom was too small, her hands and feet too big. Her hair kept sticking up, and there was a pimple nestled in the fold beside her nose. "He will bring a rose for you," her father promised her. But a rose was no good. A rose could not keep her safe. It was a sword she wanted.
"Oathkeeper, I have to find the girl. I have to find his honor."
Finally the doors opened, and her betrothed strode into her father's hall. She tried to greet him, as she had been instructed, only to have blood come pouring from her mouth. She had bitten her tongue off as she waited. She spat it at the young knight's feet and saw the disgust on his face.
"Brain the beauty,"
he said in a mocking tone.
I've seen sows more beautiful than you. He tossed the rose in her face as he walked away. The griffins on his cloak rippled and blurred and changed to lions.
Jamie, she wanted to cry. Jamie, come back for me.
But her tongue lay on the floor by the rose, drowned in blood. Brain woke suddenly, gasping. She did not know where she was. The air was cold and heavy, and smelled of earth and worms and mould. She was lying on a pallet beneath a mound of sheepskins, with rock above her head and roots poking through the walls. The only light came from a tallow candle, smoking in a pool of melted wax. She pushed aside the sheepskins. Someone had stripped her of her clothes and armour, she saw. She was clad in a brown woollen shift, thin but freshly washed. Her forearm had been splintered and bound up with linen, though. One side of her face felt wet and stiff. When she touched herself, she found some sort of damp poultice covering her cheek and jaw and ear.
Bite her.
Brian got to her feet. Her legs felt weak as water, her head as light as air.
Is anyone there?
Something moved in one of the shadowed alcoves behind the candle. An old grey man clad in rags. The blankets that had covered him slipped to the floor. He sat up and rubbed his eyes.
Lady Brian, he gave me a fright. I was dreaming.
No, she thought. That was me.
What place is this? Is this a dungeon? A cave. Like rats, we must run back to our holes when the dogs come sniffing after us, and there are more dogs every day.
He was clad in the ragged remains of an old robe, pink and white. His hair was long and grey and tangled. The loose skin of his cheeks and chin was covered with coarse stubble.
Are you hungry? Could you keep down a cup of milk, perhaps some bread and honey?
I want my clothes, my sword.
She felt naked without her mail, and she wanted Oathkeeper at her side.
The way out. Show me the way out.
The floor of the cave was dirt and stone, rough beneath the soles of her feet. Even now she felt light-headed, as if she were floating. The flickering light cast queer shadows.
Spirits of the slain, she thought, dancing all about me, hiding when I turned to look at them.
Everywhere she saw holes and cracks and crevices, but there was no way to know which passage led out, which would take her deeper into the cave, and which went nowhere. All were black as pitch.
Might I feel your brow, my lady?
Her jailer's hand was scarred and hard with callous, yet strangely gentle.
Your fever has broken,
he announced in a voice flavoured with the accents of the free cities.
Well and good, just yesterday your flesh felt as if it were on fire. Jane feared that we might lose you. Jane, the tall girl, the very one, though she's not so tall as you, my lady. Long Jane, the men call her, it was she who set your arm and splinted it, as well as any maester. She did what she could for your face as well, washing out the wounds with boiled ale to stop the mortification. Even so, a human bite is a filthy thing. That is where the fever came from, I'm certain.
The grey man touched her bandaged face.
We had to cut away some of the flesh. Your face will not be pretty, I fear.
It never has been pretty.
Scars, you mean? My lady, that creature chewed off half your cheek.
Brian could not help but flinch.
Every knight has battle scars,
Sir Goodwin had warned her when she asked him to teach her the sword.
Is that what you want, child?
Her old master-at-arms had been talking about sword cuts, though. He could never have anticipated biter's pointed teeth.
Why set my bones and wash my wounds if you only mean to hang me? Why, indeed?
He glanced at the candle, as if he could no longer bear to look at her.
You fought bravely at the inn, they tell me.
Lem should not have left the crossroads. He was told to stay close, hidden, to come at once if he saw smoke rising from the chimney. But when word reached him that the mad dog of Saltpans had been seen making his way north along the Green Fork, he took the bait. We have been hunting that lot for so long. Still, he ought to have known better. As he was, it was half a day before he realized that the mummers had used a stream to hide their tracks and doubled back behind him. And then he lost more time circling around a column of Frey knights. If not for you, only corpses might have remained at the inn by the time that Lem and his men got back. That was why Jane dressed your wounds, mayhaps. Whatever else you may have done, you won those wounds honourably, in the best of causes.
Whatever else you may have done?
What is it that you think I've done? She said. Who are you?
We were king's men when we began, the man told her, but king's men must have a king, and we have none. We were brothers, too, but now our brotherhood is broken. I do not know who we are, if truth be told, nor where we might be going. I only know the road is dark. The fires have not shown me what lies at its end.
I know where it ends. I've seen the corpses in the trees.
Fires, Brian repeated. All at once she understood.
You are the Mearish priest, the Red Wizard.
He looked down at his ragged robes and smiled ruefully.
The Pink Pretender, rather. I am Saurus, later Mir. Aye, a bad priest and a worse wizard.
You ride with Dondarrion, the Lightning Lord.
Lightning comes and goes, and then is seen no more.
So too with men. Lord Beric's fire has gone out to this world, I fear. A grimmer shadow leads us in his place.
The Hound? The priest pursed his lips.
The Hound is dead and buried.
I saw him in the woods.
A fever dream, my lady. He said he would hang me. Even dreams can lie. My lady, how long has it been since you have eaten? Surely you are famished.
She was, she realized. Her belly felt hollow.
Food. Food would be welcome, thank you.
A meal, then. Sit. We will talk more, but first a meal. Wait here.
Thoris lit a taper from the second candle and vanished into a black hole beneath a ledge of rock. Brian found herself alone in the small cave.
For how long, though?
She prowled the chamber, looking for a weapon. Any sort of weapon would have served. A staff, a club, a dagger. She found only rocks. One fit her fist nicely. But she remembered the whispers, and what happened when Shagwell tried to pit a stone against a knife. When she heard the priest's returning footsteps, she let the rock fall to the cavern floor and resumed her seat. Thoris had bread and cheese and a bowl of stew.
"I am sorry," he said. "The last of the milk has soured, and the honey is all gone. Food grows scant. Still, this will fill you."
The stew was cold and greasy, the bread hard, the cheese harder. Brian had never eaten anything half so good.
"Are my companions here?"
she asked the priest, as she was spooning up the last of the stew.
"The septon was set free to go upon his way. There was no harm in him. The others are here, awaiting judgment."
"Judgment?" she frowned. "Podrick Payne is just a boy. He says he is a squire. You know how boys will boast.
The imp squire, he has fought in battles by his own admission. He's even killed, to hear him tell it."
"A boy," she said again, "have pity."
"My lady," Thora said, "I do not doubt that kindness and mercy and forgiveness can still be found somewhere in these seven kingdoms, but do not look for them here. This is a cave, not a temple. When men must live like rats in the dark beneath the earth, they soon run out of pity, as they do of milk and honey."
"And justice?
Can that be found in caves?"
"Justice? Thora smiled wanly. I remember, Justice, it had a pleasant taste. Justice was what we were about when Beric led us, or so we told ourselves. We were king's men, knights and heroes, but some nights are dark and full of terror, my lady. War makes monsters of us all.
Are you saying you are monstrous?
I am saying we are human. You're not the only one with wounds, Lady Brian. Some of my brothers were good men when this began. Some were, well, less good, shall we say. Though there are those who say it does not matter how a man begins, but only how he ends. I suppose it's the same for women. The priest got to his feet. Our time together is at an end, I fear. I hear my brothers coming. Our lady sends for you. Brian heard their footsteps and saw torchlight flickering in the passage.
You told me she had got a fair market.
And so she had. She returned whilst we were sleeping. She never sleeps herself.
I will not be afraid, she told herself,
but it was too late for that.
I will not let them see my fear,
she promised herself instead. There were four of them. Hard men with haggard faces, clad in mail and scale and leather. She recognized one of them, the man with one eye from her dreams. The biggest of the four wore a stained and tattered yellow cloak.
"Enjoy the food?" he asked. "I hope so. It's the last food you'd ever like to eat."
He was brown-haired, bearded, brawny, with a broken nose that had healed badly.
"I know this man," Brian thought. "You are the Hound,"
he grinned. His teeth were awful, crooked, and streaked brown with rot.
"I suppose I am, seeing as how my lady went and killed the last one."
He turned his head and spat. She remembered lightning flashing, the mud beneath her feet.
"It was Rorge I killed. He took the helm from Cleggan's grave, and you stole it off his corpse."
"I didn't hear him objecting."
Thora sucked in his breath in dismay.
"Is this true? A dead man's helm? Have we fallen that low?"
The big man scowled at him.
"It's good steel. There's nothing good about that helm, nor the men who wore it," said the Red Priest. "Sandor Clegane was a man in torment, and Rorsch a beast in human skin. I'm not them." "Then why show the world their face? Savage, snarling, twisted? Is that who you would be, Lem?" "The sight of it will make my foes afraid." "The sight of it makes me afraid." "Close your eyes, then."
The man in the yellow cloak made a sharp gesture.
"Bring the whore."
Brian did not resist. There were four of them, and she was weak and wounded, naked beneath the woolen shift. She had to bend her neck to keep from hitting her head as they marched her through the twisting passage. The way ahead rose sharply, turning twice before emerging in a much larger cavern full of outlaws. A fire pit had been dug in the centre of the floor, and the air was blue with smoke. Men clustered near the flames, warming themselves against the chill of the cave. Others stood along the walls or sat cross-legged on straw pallets. There were women, too, and even a few children peering out from behind their mother's skirts. The one face Brian knew belonged to Long Jane Heddle. A trestle table had been set up across the cave, in a cleft in the rock. Behind it sat a woman, all in grey, cloaked and hooded. In her hand was a crown, a bronze circlet ringed by iron swords. She was studying it, her fingers stroking the blades as if to test their sharpness. Her eyes glimmered under her hood. Grey was the colour of the Silent Sisters, the handmaidens of the stranger. Brian felt her shiver climb up her spine.
"Stoneheart."
"My lady," said the big man, "here she is." "Aye," added the one-eyed man, "the King Slayer's whore."
She flinched. "Why would you call me that?"
"If I had a silver stag for every time you said his name, oh, I'd be as rich as your friends, the Lannisters."
"That was only... you do not understand."
"Don't we, though?"
The big man laughed.
I think we might. There's a stink of lying about you, Liddy.
That's not so.
Another of the outlaws stepped forward, a younger man in a greasy sheepskin jerkin. In his hand was Oathkeeper.
This says it is.
His voice was frosted with the accents of the North. He slid the sword from its scabbard and placed it in front of Lady Stoneheart. In the light from the fire pit, the red and black ripples in the blade almost seemed to move. But the woman in grey had eyes only for the pommel. A golden lion's head, with ruby eyes that shone like two red stars.
There is this as well.
Thoris of Myr drew a parchment from his sleeve and put it down next to the sword. It bears the boy king's seal, and says the bearer is about his business. Lady Stoneheart set the sword aside to read the letter.
The sword was given me for a good purpose, said Brian. Sir Jamie swore an oath to Catelyn Stark.
Before his friends cut her throat for her, that must have been, said the big man in the yellow cloak. Oh, we all know about the Kingslayer and his oaths.
That's no good,
Brian realized. No words of mine will sway them.
She plunged ahead despite that.
He promised Lady Catelyn her daughters, but by the time we'd reached King's Landing, they were gone. Jamie sent me out to seek the Lady Sansa.
And if you had found her, asked the young Northman, what were you to do with her?
Protect her. Take her somewhere safe.
The big man laughed.
Where's that? Cersei's dungeon?
No.
Deny it all you want. The sword says you're a liar. Are we supposed to believe the Lannisters are handing out gold and ruby swords to foes? That the Kingslayer meant for you to hide the girl from his own twin? I suppose the paper with a boy king seal was just in case you needed to wipe your ass. And then there's the company you keep.
The big man turned and beckoned. The ranks of outlaws parted, and two more captives were brought forth.
The boy was the imp's own squire, milady, he said to Lady Stoneheart. T'other is one of Randall Bloody Tarly's bloody household knights.
Hyle Hunt had been beaten so badly that his face was swollen almost beyond recognition. He stumbled as they shoved him and almost fell. Podrick caught him by the arm.
Sir, the boy said miserably, when he saw Brian, my lady, sorry, you have nothing to be sorry for.
Brian turned to Lady Stoneheart.
Whatever treachery you think I may have done, my lady, Podrick and Sir Hyle were no part of it.
They're lions, said the one-eyed man. That's enough. I say they hang. Tarly's hanged a score of ours. Past time we strung up some of his.
Sir Hyle gave Brian a faint smile.
My lady, he said, you should have wed me when I made my offer. Now I fear you're doomed to die a maid, and me, a poor man.
Let them go,
Brian pleaded. The woman in grey gave no answer. She studied the sword, the parchment, the bronzen iron crown. Finally, she reached up under her jaw and grasped her neck, as if she meant to throttle herself. Instead, she spoke. Her voice was halting, broken, tortured. The sound seemed to come from her throat, part croak, part wheeze, part death-rattle.
The language of the damned, thought Brian. I don't understand. What did she say?
She asked the name of this blade of yours, said the young Northman, in his sheepskin jerkin.
Oathkeeper,
Brian answered. The woman in grey hissed through her fingers. Her eyes were two red pits burning in the shadows. She spoke again.
No, she says. Call it Oathbreaker, she says. It was made for treachery and murder. She names it False Friend, like you. To whom have I been false?
To her, the Northman said.
Can it be that my lady has forgotten that you once swore her your service?
There was only one woman that the Maid of Tarth had ever sworn to serve.
That cannot be, she said. She's dead.
Huh?
Death, and guessed right. muttered Long Jane Heddle.
They don't mean so much as they used to, neither one.
Lady Stoneheart lowered her hood and unwound the grey wool scarf from her face. Her hair was dry and brittle, white as bone. Her brow was mottled green and grey, spotted with the brown blooms of decay. The flesh of her face clung in ragged strips from her eyes down to her jaw. Some of the rips were crusted with dried blood, but others gaped open to reveal the skull beneath.
Her face, Graham thought, her face was so strong and handsome, her skin so smooth and soft. Lady Caitlin?
Tears filled her eyes.
They said that you were dead.
She is, said Thoros of Myr. The frays slashed her throat from ear to ear. When we found her by the river, she was 3 days dead. Arwen begged me to give her the kiss of life, but it had been too long. I would not do it, so Lord Beric put his lips to hers instead, and the flame of life passed from him to her, and she rose. May the Lord of Light protect us. She rose.
Am I dreaming still? Brian wondered. Is this another nightmare, born from Biter's teeth? I never betrayed her. Tell her that. I swear it by the Seven. I swear it by my sword.
The thing that had been Catelyn Stark took hold of her throat again, fingers pinching at the ghastly long slash in her neck, and choked out more sounds.
Words are wind, she says. The Northman told Brian, she says that you must prove your faith.
How? Asked Brian.
With your sword. Oathkeeper, you call it? Then keep your oath to her, milady says.
What does she want of me?
She wants her son alive, or the men who killed him dead, said the big man. She wants to feed the crows, like they did at the Red Wedding. Freys and Bolton's, eh? We'll give her those, as many as she likes. All she asks from you is Jaime Lannister.
Jaime? The name was a knife twisting in her belly.
Lady Caitlin, you do not understand. Jaime, he saved me from being raped when the bloody mummers took us, and later he came back for me. He leapt into the bear pit empty-handed. I swear to you, he is not the man he was. He sent me after Sansa to keep her safe. He could not have had a part in the Red Wedding.
Lady Caitlin's fingers dug deep into her throat, and the words came rattling out, choked and broken, a stream as cold as ice. The Northman said,
She says you must choose, take the sword and slay the Kingslayer, or be hanged for a betrayer. The sword or the noose, she says. Choose, she says. Choose.
Brian remembered her dream, waiting in her father's hall for the boy she was to marry. In the dream she had bitten off her tongue.
My mouth was full of blood.
She took a ragged breath and said,
I will not make that choice.
There was a long silence. Then Lady Stoneheart spoke again. This time Brian understood her words. There were only two.
Hang them,
she croaked.
As you command, my lady, said the big man.
They bound Brian's wrists with rope again and led her from the cavern up a twisting stony path to the surface. It was morning outside, she was surprised to see. Shafts of pale dawn light were slanting through the trees.
So many trees to choose from, she thought. They will not need to take us far.
Nor did they. Beneath a crooked willow, the outlaw slipped a noose about her neck, jerked it tight, and tossed the other end of the rope over a limb. Hyle Hunt and Podrick Payne were given elms. Sir Hyle was shouting that he would kill Jaime Lannister, but the hound cuffed him across the face and shut him up. He had done the helm again.
If you got crimes to confess to your gods, this would be the time to see them.
Podrick has never harmed you. My father will ransom him. Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle. Send Podrick with my bones to Evenfall, and you'll have sapphire, silver, whatever you want.
I want my wife and daughter back, said the hound. Can your father give me that? If not, he can get boggard. The boy will rot beside you. Wolves will gnaw your bones.
Do you mean to hang her, Lem? Asked the one-eyed man. Or do you figure to talk the bitch to death?
The hound snatched the end of the rope from the man holding it.
Let's see if she can dance,
he said, and gave a yank. Brian felt the hemp constricting, digging into her skin, jerking her chin upwards. Sir Hyle was cursing them eloquently, but not the boy. Podrick never lifted his eyes, not even when his feet were jerked up off the ground.
If this is another dream, it's time for me to awaken. If this is real, it's time for me to die.
All she could see was Podrick, the noose around his thin neck, his legs twitching. Her mouth opened. Pod was kicking, choking, dying. Brian sucked the air in desperately, even as the rope was strangling her. Nothing had ever hurt so much. She screamed a word. Cersei. Septa Moel was a white-haired harridan, with a face as sharp as an axe and lips pursed in perpetual disapproval. This one still has her maidenhead, I'll wager, Cersei thought, though by now it's hard and stiff as boiled leather. Six of the High Sparrow's knights escorted her, with the rainbow sword of their reborn order emblazoned on their kite shields. Septa, Cersei sat beneath the Iron Throne, clad in green silk and golden lace. Tell His High Holiness that we are vexed with him. He presumes too much. Emeralds glimmered on her fingers and in her golden hair. The eyes of court and city were upon her, and she meant for them to see Lord Tywin's daughter. By the time this mummer's farce was done, they would know they had but one true queen. But first, we must dance the dance and never miss a step. Lady Marjorie is my son's true and gentle wife, his helpmate and consort. His High Holiness had no cause to lay his hands upon her person, or to confine her and her young cousins, who are so dear to all of us. I demand that he release them. Septa Moel's stern expression did not flicker.
I shall convey your grace's words to His High Holiness, but it grieves me to say that the young queen and her ladies cannot be released until and unless their innocence has been proved.
Innocence? Why, you only need to look upon their sweet young faces to see how innocent they are.
A sweet face oft hides a sinner's heart.
Lord Merryweather spoke up from the council table.
What offence have these young maids been accused of, and by whom?
The Septa said,
Mega Tyrell and Eleanor Tyrell stand accused of lewdness, fornication, and conspiracy to commit high treason. Alla Tyrell has been charged with witnessing their shame and helping them conceal it. All this Queen Marjorie also has been accused of, as well as adultery and high treason.
Cersei put a hand to her breast. Tell me, who is spreading such calumnies about my good daughter? I do not believe a word of this. My sweet son loves Lady Marjorie with all his heart. She could never have been so cruel as to play him false.
The accuser is a knight of your own household. Sir Osney Kettleblack has confessed his carnal knowledge of the Queen to the High Septon himself before the altar of the Father.
At the council table, Harry Swift gasped, and Grand Maester Pycelle turned away. A buzz filled the air, as if a thousand wasps were loose in the throne room. Some of the ladies in the galleries began to slip away, followed by a stream of petty lords and knights from the back of the hall. The gold cloaks let them go, but the queen had instructed Sir Usfrid to make a note of all who fled. Suddenly the Tyrell rose does not smell so sweet. "Sir Osney is young and lusty, I will grant you," the queen said, "but a faithful knight for all that. If he says that he was part of this, no, it cannot be. Marjorie is a maiden."
"She is not. I examined her myself at the behest of His High Holiness. Her maidenhead is not intact. Sceptre Eglantine and Sceptre Melisent will say the same, as will Queen Marjorie's own sceptre, Nisterica, who has been confined to a penitent cell for her part in the Queen's shame. Lady Mega and Lady Eleanor were examined as well. Both were found to have been broken."
The wasps were growing so loud that the Queen could hardly hear herself think. "I do hope the little Queen and her cousins enjoyed those rides of theirs." Lord Merryweather thumped his fist on the table.
"Lady Marjorie had sworn solemn oaths attesting to her maidenhood, to her grace, the Queen, and her late father. Many here bore witness. Lord Tyrell has also testified to her innocence, as has the Lady Olena, whom we all know to be above reproach. Would you have us believe that all of these noble people lied to us?"
"Perhaps they were deceived as well, my lord," said Sceptre Moel. "I cannot speak to this. I can only swear to the truth of what I discovered for myself when I examined the queen."
The picture of this sour old crone poking her wrinkled finger up Marjorie's little pink cunt was so droll that Cersei almost laughed.
"We insist that His High Holiness allow our own maesters to examine my good daughter to determine if there is any shred of truth to these slanders. Grand Maester Pycelle shall accompany Sceptre Moel back to beloved Baelor Sept, and return to us with the truth about our Marjorie's maidenhead."
Pycelle had gone the colour of curdled white. At council meetings, the wretched old fool cannot say enough, but now that I need a few words from him, he's lost the power of speech, the queen thought, before the old man finally came out with,
"There is no need for me to examine her private parts." His voice was a quaver. "I grieve to say, Queen Marjorie is no maiden. She has required me to make her moon tea. Not once, but many times."
The uproar that followed was all that Cersei Lannister could have ever hoped for. Even the royal herald, beating on the floor with his staff, did little to quell the noise. The queen let it wash over her for a few heartbeats, savouring the sounds of the little queen's disgrace. When it had gone on long enough, she rose, stone-faced, and commanded that the gold cloaks clear the hall. "Marjorie Tyrell is done," she thought, exulting. Her white knights fell in around her as she made her exit through the king's door beyond the Iron Throne. Boris Blunt, Merrin Trant, and Usman Kettleblack, the last of the king's guard, still remaining in the city. Moonboy was standing beside the door, holding his rattle in his hand and gaping at the confusion with his big round eyes. A fool he may be, but he wears his folly honestly. Maggie the Frog should have been in Motley too, for all she knew about the morrow. Cersei prayed the old fraud was screaming down in hell. The younger queen, whose coming she had foretold, was finished, and if that prophecy could fail, so could the rest. No golden shrouds, no Valonqar. I am free of your croaking malice at last. The remnants of her small council followed her out. Harry Swift appeared dazed. He stumbled at the door and might have fallen if Orion Waters had not caught him by the arm. Even Orton Merryweather seemed anxious.
"These small folk are fond of the little queen," he said. "They will not take well to this. I fear what might happen next, Your Grace."
"Lord Merryweather is right," said Lord Waters. "If it please Your Grace, I will launch the rest of our new Drummonds. The sight of them upon the Blackwater, with King Tommen's banner flying from their masts, will remind the city who rules here, and keep them safe should the mobs decide to run riot again."
He left the rest unspoken. Once on the Blackwater, his Drummonds could stop Mace Tyrell from bringing his army back across the river, just as Tyrion had once stopped Stannis. Highgarden had no sea power of its own this side of Westeros. They relied upon the Redwyn fleet, presently on his way back to the arbour. "A prudent measure," the Queen announced. "Until the storm has passed, I want your ships crewed and on the water." Sir Harry Swift was so pale and damp, he looked about to faint.
"When word of this reaches Lord Tyrell, his fury will know no bounds. There will be blood in the streets."
"The night of the yellow chicken," Cersei mused. "You ought to take a worm for your sigil, sir. A chicken is too bold for you." "If Mace Tyrell were not even assault Storm's End, how do you imagine he would ever dare attack the guards?" When he was done blathering, she said, "It must not come to blood, and I mean to see that it does not. I will go to Baelor Sept myself, to speak to Queen Marjorie and the High Septon. Tommen loves them both, I know, and would want me to make peace between them."
"Peace?" Sir Harris dabbed at his brow with a velvet sleeve. "If peace is possible, that is very brave of you."
"Some sort of trial may be necessary," said the Queen, "to disprove these base calumnies and lies, and show the world that our sweet Marjorie is the innocent we all know her to be."
"Aye," said Merryweather, "but this High Septon may want to try the Queen himself, as the faith once tried men of old."
"I hope so," Cersei thought. Such a court was not like to look with favour on treasonous queens who spread their legs for singers and profaned the maiden's holy rites to hide their shame. "The important thing is to find the truth. I'm sure we all agree," she said.
"And now, my lord, you must excuse me. I must go see the king. He should not be alone at such a time."
Tommen was fishing for cats when his mother returned to him. Dorcas had made him a mouse with scraps of fur and tied it on a long string at the end of an old fishing pole. The kittens loved to chase it, and the boy liked nothing better than jerking it about the floor as they pounced after it. He seemed surprised when Cersei gathered him up in her arms and kissed him on his brow.
"What's that for, Mother? Why are you crying?"
"Because you're safe," she wanted to tell him.
"Because no harm will ever come to you."
"You are mistaken. A lion never cries." There would be time later to tell him about Marjorie and her cousins. "There are some warrants that I need you to sign." For the king's sake, the queen had left the names off the arrest warrants. Tommen signed them blank and pressed his seal into the warm wax happily, as he always did. Afterward, she sent him off with Jocelyn Swift. Sir Osfred Kettleblack arrived as the ink was drying. Cersei had written in the names herself. Sir Talad the Tall, Jalabar Zo, Hamish the Harper, Hugh Clifton, Mark Mullendore, Bayard Norcross, Lambert Turnberry, Horace Redwyn, Hubber Redwyn, and a certain churl named Wat, who called himself the Blue Bard.
"So many!"
Sir Osfred shuffled through the warrants, as weary of the words as if they had been roaches crawling across the parchment. None of the Kettleblacks could read.
10.
"You have 6,000 gold cloaks, sufficient for 10, I would think. Some of the clever ones may have fled, if the rumours reach their ears in time. If so, it makes no matter. Their absence only makes them look that much more guilty. Sir Talad is a bit of an oaf, and may try to resist you.
See that he does not die before confessing, and do no harm to any of the others. A few may well be innocent. It was important that the Redwyn twins be